All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Here we are at Ground Zero in Salt Lake City for the podcast. Salt Lake City gets a bad rap. It's a little red dot in a sea of blue. It's a great, fabulous gay city, and some of us like it here. I like the gay bars because I can dance without getting hit on. I know some people have that backwards, but no, that's really the way it is for me, I promise.
I like the gay bars because it's not at all hard to get a drink at a gay bar. The bartenders pay attention to you and call you sweetie.
They don't cut your alcohol in half?
No, but the pretty blonde at the regular bar, all you can do is wait in line and wave and cough. But the gay bar, it's all, here you go, sweetie. What can I get you?
Flip, you're going to have to give me a lesson on how do I gay it up so I get a better drink? Because apparently you know some things that I don't.
No, I'm not kidding. Not that I do it much, but all of my experiences in gay bars have been excellent. It's just a different vibe. And, you know, sometimes people say flattering things and you say, thanks, I'm not gay. And they say something snarky, and you say something snarky back, and everybody's still friends. It's fantastic. Maybe there's some guy getting a blow in the bathroom, but it doesn't make any difference to my beer.
Whatever. All right. And, of course, Flip is here on the panel again. Hi, Flip. Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. And, of course, my old friend and mentor, Thane. Welcome back, Thane.
Thanks, John. It's good to be back.
You know, Thane's wearing a white shirt.
It's
today.
Tuesday,
and
I literally wear a white shirt every Tuesday.
So 10 years ago, when I first was leaving the church, it was great because we all had this day off in the state of Utah on Sundays. We could go to Costco, and they'd still have samples, but they'd just be piled high, and there'd be nobody there. And you could go to the amusement parks and the ski resorts. This has changed.
The Mormons. It's the gays. You just mentioned it. It's the gays in Salt Lake. They've ruined everything.
It might be the gays. But here's the thing that's happened recently. Now it's just as crowded. It's just as crowded on Saturday as on Sunday. But there's a new trend I've noticed. And that's that they're all there in their church clothes. Like, they've given up all pretense. Like, I was at the grocery store. It was crowded. And there's all these guys walking around in their little short sleeve white shirts and ties, you know.
Buying energy drinks.
Yeah, I saw that on Sunday this week.
I know, it's annoying.
At the Walmart, and like, those people just came out of church.
Yeah, like, go back to church. Not because they need to go to church, but because I want them out of my store.
I'm trying to shop here.
If the ox is in the mire, you have to get them out. Yeah, if you're out of Doritos,
that is a lot.
You
got to
go to Harmon's.
So Mormon culture is indeed changing. And all the way from the West Coast.
Yeah.
Becca.
Hi.
I said it right, right?
Yes.
Oh, excellent.
Yes.
Becca, what did you have to do to get on the podcast?
Well, I sent an email to you and Randy.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to be in town that day. I'm going to come to the recording.
I
don't have a penis. And they were like, great, come on.
We don't like competition. I don't mean to belittle your experience here, because I'm glad you're here and we were talking before and you're vibrant and you'll fit right in, but the bar is pretty low to getting on the podcast. I've always wanted to have room for everybody to come on and talk, and sometimes people have complained about mediocre panelists, and I say, well, yeah.
That's what you get when you call the night before and say, hey, Thane.
All right, Thane, just because I'm not prepared.
That's what you get.
You get Thane.
And so we don't have a professional panel oftentimes. It's because I think the experience of everybody and everybody's voice is interesting, which is why I set up the Voices podcast. Not just because it was really, when I first was leaving, I think I found the repository of these personal narratives on, like, RFM had some, and Post-Mormon had some, and some of these websites had them, and they were just refreshing. It made me feel like I wasn't crazy, like I wasn't alone. And that's the point behind Voices. So if you haven't yet discovered our Voices podcast, go to mormonexpression.com/voices. It does have its own iTunes feed, so if you want to search for it out there. And these are just personal stories and narratives. Some of them are fascinating. Some of them are
Well, I'm sure they're
I'm
all
on there, so they're not all interesting. Fabulous.
Somebody will find every one of them interesting.
They well, are. They're interesting stories.
Even if they're not stellar podcasting, it's just it's fun to me to watch the pile grow. Because, you know, like we always talk about, coming out of the church, you feel alone. And the stories just keep piling up. And, of course, yeah, some of them are mundane. And that's fine, because a lot of people's exit stories are kind of mundane. But you're not alone.
But we have lots of interesting things out there. Transgenders, and I think I cry on mine. It's really sad. All right. Let's jump into the news. It's a slow news day in Mormonism. First of all, I'm oftentimes interested in not just what the news stories are, but what the national press picks up, which is interesting because there's a new fascination with the culture of Mormonism. In the news for 30 or 40 years, there's always been an interest in how weird Mormonism is. I mean, that's always been a predominant theme. But there's an I don't know if it's from the Book of Mormon musical or other things. This week, national press picked up a story about a prom in New Jersey. So this is really a story about a story. What I found fascinating by this is and I know I tend to be critical of Mormon culture quite a bit, but I think the story was refreshing, and I think it shows sort of the growth and maturity of the church, because the prom itself was welcoming. And it shed away a lot of the sort of hoo-ha around proms. And they talked about there weren't limousines and there weren't, you know, $10,000 dresses. And it was fairly well lit. I think a lot of us, as we come out of the church and we suffered in the church from all kinds of sexual repression and shame, we forget that navigating sexuality as a teenager is hard. And kids are coming of age, and things are confusing. I will confess that I did not kiss a girl until after my mission. I was 21 before I kissed a lady. Don't ask me about the boys. And I'm perfectly fine with that. That the fact that, because the stress of relationships, and especially, can you imagine dating a 15-year-old girl? It must be just awful. Because I'm a 15-year-old girl at heart. I figured that out. Psychologically, I'm a 15-year-old girl. But the fact that I could concentrate on my studies, I didn't have to worry about that, and that was really nice for me as a kid, because it reduced a lot of that stress and a lot of that pressure. And I think it was a good reminder to me as I read the article that sometimes we put a lot of stuff on kids about dress and grooming and these pressures and stresses. There was another big story that went around about a girl who got kicked out of a dance. I think it was in Virginia. It had nothing to do with Mormonism, but she had on and she had on this, it was sort of a cocktail-y dress. She acknowledged in the story that the dress and grooming standards were the dress needed to go down to her fingertips, and she acknowledged that her dress would crawl up above that. The young woman, and she sort of blamed it on the patriarchy and all this kind of stuff. But it's a hard thing to navigate, and that the church here in out of state was reaching out to other youth, allowing them to come into the dance, create a safe space where kids can have fun and not have to worry about all this sexual pressure. I think it's kind of a positive thing. I was charmed to read the story.
I agree. And I thought initially you were talking about the other story about the dress standard. And, you know, I had the same reaction that you did. It's like you don't have to wear the tightest, the shortest dress, you know, to make an impression at prom. It's okay if you don't make an impression at prom.
Yeah, because there is this tension between, you know, so-called slut shaming and also saying, well, let's just – because there's an element of the populace that seems to say that anytime a dress and grooming standard is set up, and let's be clear, they impact women off much more often than they do men. It's not as easy of an issue as it seems, because there's a tendency for some of us who've left fundamentalist religions to be like, hey, anything goes, you know. But this is a lot of pressure on these kids, and I don't know where the line is there in saying, hey. That there's things you probably shouldn't wear. And unfortunately, we're in this element of society where the Facebook and all the social media, they're just wanting to pounce. You know, and I read the story, I'm like, is this really a story? A girl was kicked out of the dance for too short of a dress. Then they offered her money back, but she wanted money back for all of her mates too. And that's what got her upset. And it's just kind of like, why is this in the national press? Yeah. Doesn't this happen like every Thursday or every Friday? I don't know. But it's hard. So good on the church as the church starts realizing that they can let other people in. Because I remember, do any of you guys here remember dance cards? Or is that just you have to be my age for dance cards? We used to swap them around all the time. I remember I went to a dance one time with a dance card from a friend of mine. Her name was Mahjong. And that's what my dance card said. Of course, I look like a Mahjong, right? So, yeah. All right, our other story, of course, everybody knows the national holiday of the Mormons entering the valley. Well, actually, Brigham Young entering the valley because the rest of the train entered 3 days earlier. On July 24th, Brigham Young entered the Salt Lake Valley. This is Pioneer Day here.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad. There's a lot of Mormons on the West Coast. Do you guys celebrate it out there?
Oh, yeah. There's a stake Pioneer Day activity every year, and it's not ever on Pioneer Day. It's like the Saturday before or something.
What do you do? Do you all celebrate your Utah heritage? You dress up like a Utahard and you get
they'll do like pioneer garb and, you know, some, I don't know, to be honest with you, I only went one time, but I think they had, you know, make a little doll kind of activities and
corncob dolls.
Yeah.
Eat whorehound
like
candy, all that good stuff.
So anyway, there's a big parade. It's the biggest parade in Salt Lake City. Probably going to soon be surpassed by Pride Parade, which is in a couple weeks. But the Mormons Building Bridges, which is an organization to try to show support for people who traditionally would be ousted by the church, namely gay and lesbians. It's Mormons Building Bridges, I believe, that they had applied for an entry into the float entry, and they were denied because they didn't meet community standards. And I know I've been on this theme a lot lately in the last couple months, that the church is its own worst enemy. Like, you have all of these LDS and ex-LDS organizations, and you have the one called Building Bridges, right? The one out there that says, let's all just get along and be nice to each other, and they're the ones who are going to be denied. Like, they're always going after the wrong target, right? Like, I chastised them with very harsh language a couple of weeks ago because they sued that dating site because they used the word Mormon, and it says Mormon out there on my window, and, you know, who's less standards? Who's less LDS standards? I don't understand why they do stuff like that, because all they have to and okay, so the parade is majorly sponsored by KSL-TV and all this kind of stuff, and I don't know who runs it, but it's just like, guys, stop fighting this stuff. When do the conservatives realize that they've lost the gay war? It's over, right? We're just in mop-up operations.
And not yet.
At what point did you just go surrender to the Allies and just say, I'm done, I want to go back to Bavaria? Because it's over. That was for you.
Hey, look, it's, what are we, 10 minutes in, 15 minutes in? Good.
Thane tells me I always break Godwin's law.
Godwin's, yeah. He Godwin's 15 minutes in. Mark it on your...
I still think the Nazis are the best metaphor ever created.
You think they're a good metaphor for everything.
They are! And they work on every level.
Larson, that's a German name, right?
No. All right, so that's our news for the day. Okay, I cut my teeth in the online world back even when I was still a member of the church on these message boards that were devoted to apologetics. And so in a lot of ways, although the last few years I've moved away from it, apologetics has been something that sort of kind of turned me into who I am in terms of dealing with it. And it's partly because as a young college student at BYU, I was struggling, as one does, with trying to reconcile reality with my religion, and so I went into the BYU bookstore and got some apologetic materials, and I found it was complete and utter bullshit. And this was surprising to me as a believer, because I could see through it. It was so transparently bad, and I just retreated from it completely for the years that I was a faithful believer. And then it was only when I went to my faith crisis that I started engaging it again, and I really started engaging the apologist directly. Apologetics comes from the term apologia, which really means to explain. But apologetics has always been a communication from inside a religion to outside a religion. And generally noted, the first Christian apologist is Justin Martyr, who is writing in the 2nd century. And Christianity's been losing ever since. What's funny about, if you want to be an apologist, here's my question. Have you guys ever won once? Have you ever won one argument? You know, like there's some that they... But there's, like, what are the... I want to read the book, the 10 Great Victories of Apologetics Through the Centuries. Because they end up losing every single battle. And it's just such a sad, sad discipline. I actually really respect these guys for their effort. Because it's a hard thing to defend. You know, since you're engaging outside... Religions really work internally, right? They work on this inside basis. And once you start engaging the rest of the world, you have to speak their language, and then you're out of your league.
Right. So let me go back and defend Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr was a great apologist when he was talking to Christians, and he did. You know, he argued and fought with other Christians about, you know, the nature of God and those sorts of things. And, you know, he won a few, and he lost a few, and, you know, Origen won a few and lost a few. And, you know, so when you're arguing with apologists, yeah, you can win. But, you know, did Justin Martyr ever convert any Jews? Probably not. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. I think you have a key point there, Thane, which is really, even though apologists are engaging the outside world, they're really talking to insiders. And there's a lot of tales on that. The number one thing that I think apologetics does for the church is people are happy that it exists. They're happy that it's there. Because the response that the church people give all the time is, oh, that's been dealt with. Have you all seen this?
Talked about that.
You'll bring up some argument, that's already been dealt with. As if it's like the Deseret Book published a book in 1964 on this topic. It's done. You know, the thinking's been done. So the fact that it's there, and I mentioned this before, I collect Mormon books. And I would dare say that from all years, you know, going back 150 years, about 75% of them have never been cracked. But people buy them and they give them in gifts and they put them on their shelves. And the fact that the book is there, it's like, why was the church so eager to sell Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling? Because they knew nobody would read the fucking thing. They would just give it to each other, and they'd put it on the shelf, and then they could say, it's been dealt with. See, it's in there. See,
it's
look,
really
the index,
long,
the peepstone, it's mentioned on page 227, and that done and done. We're good. We're golden.
Somebody smarter than you wrote a book, so relax.
Yes. Yes.
Right. So the apologists do have to deal. So tonight, I was going to do a top 10, but I think we have 12. So I'm talking about the areas that are most problematic for Mormon apologists, the areas that they have to deal with that are the hardest for them to deal with. And some of them are not as hard as you think. I'll give you a great example, one that the apologists should use more. Have I talked about hippopotamuses on the podcast before?
More I don't remember.
Oh, yeah, the hippopotamus. We'll go through it again.
German hippopotamus?
No, the hippopotamuses. The hippopotamus is a great apologetic argument. Hippopotamus is Greek for water horse. When the Greeks ran into the hippopotami, is that the right? The hippopotami down in Africa. They didn't look like anything in Greece, right? And a hippopotamus looks nothing like a horse. But they used a parallel. They said, oh, well, it's a water horse. And that's the way they constructed the language. This is a great apologetic answer for why the Book of Mormon language is so screwed up, why they talk about horses or whatever. Because they could say, well, the Nephites coming over when they ran into whatever.
Tapers, deer.
Deer. They said, oh, it looks like a horse. So they called it a horse. And we're going to come back to that a little bit here when we talk about loose versus tight translation. But so there are decent apologetic arguments, but some of them are not so good. All right, are we ready to get going?
Yeah.
Okay, number one on my list. And this is in no particular order. The atheist skeptical rejection of Mormon truth verification, i.e. testimony. This is a hard one for them to deal with. And I actually heard, now I don't jump on the bandwagon of making fun of Daniel Peterson. I think he's a bright guy. He's got a little shticky thing that I think is annoying, but he's a challenging, interesting fellow. But there was one time that I read where he actually acknowledged this, that this was a hard issue for them to deal with. The issue here is that the apologists, Mormon apologists, cut their teeth arguing with evangelicals. And a lot of apologetic material that you can still go into Deseret Book and buy is all about shooting down evangelical arguments. And the problem is the game changed about 15 years ago. And so the arguments were like, well, whose Jesus is the most Jesus-y, right? And then the goddamn skeptics came in and said, oh, well, we don't care anything about Jesus. And then the apologists are like, oh, what? Because they would go through and explain the weird parts of the Book of Mormon by saying, the Bible's weird too. But the skeptics say, yeah, and? You're not convincing me of anything. You know, just because your neighbor beats his wife doesn't mean that you're okay too. So the church has been built on this idea of testimony. And what the skeptics have done have said, testimony is no way of arriving at truth at all. So that cuts all the pins out from underneath apologetics, because they already have this baseline assumption that there are things like prayer and there are things like gods and there are things like emotional ways of knowing things. And this is a tough one for them to deal with.
Yeah, and we'll probably hit this later, but I think that this also falls on this problem of vocabulary. And so Mormons have a testimony, but it's a different thing than when Christians have a testimony. And Mormons pray, but it's a different thing than when Christians pray. And, you know, I think that there's a handful of these places where Mormons are using different words than Christians, and certainly different words than you know, the skeptics. And so that, you know, it falls apart, because not only can you not say, yeah, but I had, you know, I have a testimony and my testimony is firm and personal and all that, you can't even say, you know, that this testimony is valid, because they don't know what that word means, right?
Yeah, and it's a tough place to be in. I don't know if any of you remember from like your missions or whatever. And, you know, you would bear your testimony and people would look at you like, well, what are you talking about? Like, this is... Because doesn't it say in the first discussion that you're, that's in a sidebar, you're supposed to tell them what you're feeling is the spirit, you know? And it's like, it's just confusing to people. They don't know. You're speaking this language that you learned in Idaho, and nobody else speaks that language. And it turns into a big... I decided last time that I'm not going to deride circle jerks anymore.
I remember distinctly, burned into my memory, one of the key faith eroding moments was like 6 months into my mission, and I'm talking to some super learned long beard Christian of some kind, and I bear my testimony about the Book of Mormon or whatever, and he just says, my Muslim friend says all the exact same things about the Quran. And I was stumped right there. It was one of those moments, because there's several moments, because in my mission, I was in Northern California, and that was, you know, in the 80s was like the epicenter of the evangelical anti-Mormon movement. Ed Decker and Dick Baer, I met Dick Baer on my mission, operated out of there. Walter Martin operated out of there. So we got into apologetic bashes all over the place. And over and over and over again, I had all these moments where I realized my argument fails for all the same reason that yours are failing, talking with these guys. And that was the first moment that just dawned on me. As I bore my testimony, this guy says Muslims say the same thing, and I never found an answer to it.
And they oftentimes ignore it. I know our friend John DeLynn interviewed Sandra Tanner a few weeks ago.
About a week ago, yeah.
And, you know, the Tanners are great. They apply all this logic and sound science to Mormonism, but they're evangelicals, you know. So the only thing I would say is just take a look inside for a minute. You know, they have the anti-Mormon books on the one side of their little, and then they have all the Christian tracts. Just just scan the book rack a little bit. Was all I would say to the Tanners. So yeah, it's you see that application of skepticism to Mormonism, but you know, not to the basic claims of the Bible, which is that's what destroyed my faith. Because I my faith in God and all that stuff, because I got done deconstructing Mormonism and then went to Christianity as a refuge, and I found the Bible's just as bullshitty as the Book of Mormon is. It's a little bit more interesting to read, but it's still just, it's problematic. Did I give you the instruction you can't nod on the podcast?
Yeah.
That's much
better. I didn't get an instruction. I'm a therapist. I can't help it. I listen and I nod. Yeah.
How does that make you feel? All right. Okay, for our next one, abandoning changing doctrines. This is a huge problem for apologists, which is when you look at the flotsam and jetsam of the last 170 years of the church, you've introduced this concept of revelation, and we're going to talk about that on our next point. But there are so many doctrines that have come up from people that we have to accept as prophets, seers, and revelators, have been given ex cathedra from the pulpit in conference, that are just nonsense to the church itself. Do you know why you can't get any church magazines published before 1971?
We don't believe any of that stuff anymore.
We don't. It's nutty. It's crazy. It's
not even online.
No.
They're doggone embarrassing.
There was a reason that they abandoned the improvement era and went to the Ensign. It was a way for them to sort of hit the reset button. And, you know, a lot of people don't even know that it existed, that the precursor for the Ensign has existed since the 19th century. And you know, you would think, wow, here we are in the age of modern revelation. Now we have 170 years of this sort of stuff. When I first started studying out of the church, there was a thought that occurred to me. We believe that Joseph Smith is the best mortal that ever lived, second only to Jesus Christ himself, right? And he wrote a whole bunch of stuff, and I realized I'd never read any of it. How is this possible that the greatest human being that ever lived wrote a whole bunch of stuff, and I've never read it? I'll tell you why I never read it, because once you read it, you'll know why too. I'll leave that for a homework assignment. It's great. He talks about getting in fist fights with his brother and getting drunk, and he's a fun guy. I'm sure he would have been great on a Saturday night. And but there's all this stuff that's been changed. And I remember one of the first criticisms I read. I was reading as a kid in high school, reading some anti-Mormon literature, and they talked about blood atonement and the Mary, Mother of God, was not a virgin. And I was like, this is not the church I believe in. And which is true, you know, it's a good defense saying, I've never heard any of this stuff. Obviously, when we talk about Mormonism, you guys are battling a straw man. And in a sense, they are. Because there are evangelicals who try to present that stuff as if we all really secretly believe it. We'll all deny it. But, I mean, that's really not the case for most Mormons in the pews. They really don't believe that God knocked up Mary. But Brigham Young believed that, and so did a lot of others. And that was a real-life doctrine. And the apologists do have a hard time dealing with that.
All they can do is shotgun, because, you know, if we brought up the top five crazy beliefs that Mormon believe, you know, blood atonement, Adam God theory, God and Mary having physical intercourse, you know, pick five. I can bet that you didn't learn one of those five until you were 25 or 30 years old, and I didn't learn one of those, because Adam God, for instance, I didn't learn until I was 32, right? How did I live 30 years and not learn about the Adam God theory or whatever that is, doctrine?
Well, then there's part of it, because evangelicals, one of the things they love to do is they love to just quote other evangelicals, and there are some great Mormon apologetic works you can find where they trace these, like, there's a mistake made in a quote, and then it shows up in evangelical tract after evangelical tract after evangelical tract after evangelical tract. And they always use the same quote by Brigham Young on Adam is the only God we have to deal with, blah, 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 blah. And then apologists say, well, that's just one thing. And then they keep arguing around in this little circle about that. That's not the only, like, source for this. There are whole sermons on it, but they're all so lazy that they never go out and do the research. And this is why I get disappointed with evangelical anti-apologetics, is because they tend to be really lazy with their attacks on Mormonism, which has given the apologists a leg up because they can deal with these fallacious arguments that have been repeated over and over and over again.
Right, so you can engage on... So they can engage on, see, they made this error in the quote or the one little thing without having to address the larger issue, like you're saying, that came up in, it's not like a one-time thing that someone's really pulling something out
right.
of context.
In their defense, who actually wants to read the Book of Mormon or the Journal of Discourses or, come on.
Good point.
Nobody wants to read that.
Good point.
So... When I was out dealing with all these anti-Mormon apologetics, I ordered a whole bunch of anti-Mormon apologetics, and I remember specifically the "Take heed that ye be not deceived," and they just got all this mileage out of mistakes the Tanners made in their book, Mormonism: Shadow or Reality. And I don't know, they've got a half dozen things where they did quote mining, or they did this thing there, and that was so effective for me because I'm like, oh, these guys are hacks and they're liars and all that stuff. Years later, I actually held a copy of the book in my hand, and it's the size of a goddamn phone book.
It is huge.
And yeah. It was all home research, and if you look at it, it's horribly laid out, and it is paid, like, there's no damn margins. It is just blocks of text and just research, research, research. And I thought, all you pulled out of this was 12 mistakes? Those guys are better than Wikipedia.
500 pages of brick text, and they found these, these three typos.
Well, and then there's other books, like In Answer to the God Makers, which the church... gratefully took out of, which are they're lousy books. And I've used the example before of the Hugh Nibley's Evolution of Convenient Lie, which is just utter nonsense. Okay, related to the abandoning changing doctrines, which it's going to be really hard to deal with. Let me say one more thing about that. Because the word abandon, the church very, very, very rarely retracts a doctrine. I'll use the example of birth control. Do Mormons believe you can practice birth control? Hell to the no. Absolutely, Mormons cannot practice birth control, because I can show you 100 sources saying it's evil, and then I can show you one source from the 90s saying people have to prayerfully ask God. Well, the prayerfully ask God does not contradict the previous ones. It's perfectly in alignment. So if you have a logical problem where A does not equal B, and then you have 100 A's, and then you have another equation that says A or B. It's not fucking B. It's A, right? And the problem is they don't want to get up, because then you have to say, well, why did you say birth control was evil for so many years? And they just want things to go away. They just want them to disappear. And this leaves people, assholes like me, who can go through all these books and pull up these things, and they don't have a good response for them other than just to say, don't listen to him. He's an anti-Mormon. Anti-Mormons are full of lies. And then they start labeling everything anti-Mormon books and, the Journal of Discourse and whatever. So that's about abandoning. Okay, the reason abandoning doctrines are a real problem is my third point, that are problematic areas for apologists, and that's inerrancy and modern revelation. So sophisticated Mormons will tell you that inerrancy is not a doctrine of the church. And I'm here to say bullshit, because the whole foundation of Mormonism was on the idea of restoration, that the church had gone astray, and that made them lose their priesthood authority, which is what makes them operative. And it was evident in the fact that they'd introduced new doctrines, that the doctrines were in themselves wrong. So if you get like some, what's the book, The Great Apostasy by J. Reuben Clark? Is it by Clark?
Talmage.
I'm sorry. It's by Talmage. They'll go through and say, show you all these contradictions in Catholicism to the early Bible, and say this is proof positive that the church has gone astray, because the scriptures are the word of God. So if we have a church that's founded on the idea that we have to restore and get back to the pure and restored gospel, and you can show that that's not real, the whole system collapses, right? And this is why they won't really talk about this very clearly. This is the argument I keep making with homosexual marriage and giving women priesthood. People say, yeah, but they've changed so many things. They changed polygamy, and they gave the blacks the priesthood. But they said it was a policy change, you know, that the blacks were not allowed the priesthood for a while, and now they are. And with polygamy, they never really stopped it. Like, the doctrine still, DNC 132 still are there in the book. And they just said, it's on hold.
Manifesto says we're not going to do this anymore.
Yeah, for a while.
We're not going to solemnize marriages.
But the problem is, if you introduce something like, let's say, homosexuality, you allow homosexuals equal access to the church, equal access to the church covenants. They get to go to the temple. They get to be sealed together. The number of dominoes of church doctrines that just start falling and falling and falling is enormous. I do not personally see, and I'm happy to have somebody convince me elsewise, how the church can survive that. Because there's nothing left. Let's start going through programs. Let's start going through, and let alone we're talking about inerrancy. Let's go through everything the prophets have said throughout the years. The whole purpose of existence, you know, to reproduce so that they can reproduce, so they can reproduce, so they can reproduce. And things like the Relief Society and the priesthood and all these things just start falling to pieces. Well, this is the problem of a church that's based on the idea of we have a direct line from God. God tells us exactly what we're supposed to be doing. Because either you were wrong, which means you can't understand what the hell God's saying, so your whole basis of a claim of authority is shot, or God's a fucking dick, and he's telling you things that aren't true, ha ha ha, just to cause lots of pain and suffering in the world, right? Because the fact that the blacks were denied the priesthood caused people to suffer with little gain for the church. I mean, what did the church benefit from it? We got more bigots in Idaho to join the church? I mean, what's the upside of not giving, not allowing African Americans into the temple until 1978?
There's no upside.
Just you get a lily white church, I guess. That's
well, the okay, white and delightsome. That.
Yes.
Well, this goes back to your previous point, though, about abandoning the doctrines, and that's why they have to abandon them and not retract them. Because if you retract the doctrines that the previous prophets had said, this is doctrine, then it, you know, raises this giant question about the whole system.
Yeah, what else was he wrong about?
Yeah, exactly. What are they wrong about now, right, that we don't
they actually
know yet?
They do have a sort of out that I'm hinting at. They can say, "We don't. God's mysterious." No, this is what they really should be saying. We just went to the temple. We were sitting around. We were passing around the. Don't they have a box of chocolates they pass around every Wednesday? I'm not making this stuff up. You guys, look this stuff up. They have a box of chocolates that they pass around, and they do go in order. So, the guys at the bottom are always left with the nougats.
The guys at the front get the rum balls.
Yeah,
you know.
So they can just say, "We don't know. God told us that it was wrong before," and but they don't, because they don't say. When's the last time the church said anything out of authority?
I'm laughing about rum balls.
Rum balls.
We have a new giggle track. I've accomplished my goal tonight.
So I've challenged members of the church on this before. Say, give me the last revelation. Your church is fully based on revelation. This is what makes you special. Tell me the last one. You should certainly know that, right?
Yeah, you and I have talked about this before, because Brigham Young was careful to say, "I'm not the prophet."
Yes, he did.
I'm the
he
president
was.
Of the church. And you're left to understand that he thought of himself as a caretaker for the church, not a prophet receiving revelation.
The term "the prophet" was not applied to anybody else besides Joseph Smith until David O. McKay, who had sort of a God complex himself. He used to walk around in white suits.
It was during David McKay's tenure that the Kentucky Fried Chicken was founded. See?
I never made the connection.
See?
You're
now
right,
it all
the
comes
first
together.
Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise was in Salt Lake City.
Right, right.
You can still go to it. It's up at a shithole place up in Salt Lake.
It's a lovely place.
The thing that always stuck with me, because I was raised, my dad told me about Adam God, Mountain Meadows, and all of that stuff growing up, because he was a Jack Mormon and into history, and it was family history. But one of the things that he told me about, of all the things that prophets said over the years, you know, and that's changed, the thing that stuck with me and started picking it all apart is that he told me about how in the 1930s, the Brethren said from the pulpit that good Mormons don't listen to jazz. That jazz is evil, because jazz was played in the, you know, in the speakeasies and whatnot, and also it was a very Negro thing. And I was thinking about this, like, you know, they're worried about rock and roll now. And they're probably just delighted if a 15-year-old is listening to Jelly Roll Morton. But 80 years ago, that guy was as bad as Black Sabbath, right?
Yeah.
Right. I'm sure Jelly Roll refers to some sort of weird sexual practice from the 20s that I don't know about. So let's give him credit. All right. So we're talking about things that are problems for the apologist. And this inerrancy is a big problem because people can pull this stuff up and they tend to be dismissive, but they really don't have a good way of dismissing it. They really don't have a good way other than just trying to obscure it and say, oh, you're pulling this out of weird text or proof texting, whatever.
And before we get off the subject, you know, again, you keep talking about, let me give you guys a piece of advice. So here's the piece of advice. If you have continuing revelation, it's okay for today's prophet to say, that prophet didn't understand everything, but I do. So we're going to change it because I understand. And you know, isn't that what Kimball said in 1978? He goes, you know, that great... Well,
Kimball didn't say it very clearly, but actually, you know, Bruce McConkie did. Bruce McConkie came out and said, we were wrong.
The 14 Fundamentals, who wrote that?
14 Fundamentals was
Benson.
Benson. Okay. But McConkie came out and he gave a very clear apology for it. He said, we were absolutely wrong. We have new light and knowledge and we'll move forward. And that's the way to do it. But the church just does not like to do it very often, which is the problem for apologists.
That, which,
you
is, know? Which is just, it's so easy. Just say, we know more now. I pull that crap on my kids all the time. They never tumbled to it. It's like, oh, I know something now that I didn't know last week.
But
yeah.
The whole idea that, like, you know, 78, well, they just didn't ask, or it was the time, whatever it is. Like, what has to happen? Do all 15 members have to stop thinking about sex for 15 seconds at the same moment so that God can say, hey, it's okay for black people to come to church?
Well, you know, one of the things with that, they said, well, we didn't ask. Really? Right? Really? You know, the big questions of the time you're not asking. You know, you're the steward for all of humanity's spirituality, and you don't like pick up a copy of the New York Times and see what the biggest problems are going on, and happen to ask God.
They were fighting over chocolates.
Yes.
Moving along.
All right. Next point: the doctrine of the humanity of God. You know, which, of course, in Mormonism is a very clear, very well-accepted doctrine that God started as a human being and that human beings will become gods. The apologists like to talk out of both sides of their mouths on this one. And depending on their audience, they love to talk about God. They really, really want to be accepted by American Protestants. And they really love to couch things in that language and that form. And because they do so, they get trapped because they don't embrace this doctrine. This doctrine, if you take a global view of religion, is actually not that strange. The anthropomorphizing of gods is more common than the new sort of ubiquitous, omnipresent, weirdo God that the Christians worship today. An anthropomorphized God who goes down and makes it with the ladies every once in a while is more the norm, right? You know, Odin and Thor, these guys are horny and, you know, they like to get it on. And Mormons can look out and say, we're just like the Babylonians and the but they don't. They want to talk as if, us too, we believe in the same God you guys do. And they don't really believe in the God of of the Methodists. They believe in the God of the Simpsons. And they should just embrace it because it runs them into rhetorical problems. And this is one of those things where I've said before, just embrace the weirdness of Mormonism. Stop saying, oh, no, really, our God is omnipresent and omniscient and all this stuff too. Just own it, man.
Yeah, you can't be both. You gotta pick. And like you say, they argue both gods depending on the audience. Well, guess what? We live in an internet world and everybody talks to everybody.
Well, even kind of internally, I think, for Mormons, it's the same logical equivalent as Trinitarianism for all the Trinitarians, where you just go, yeah, it's both. Sure, why not? It's God. Relax.
Right. And then, you know, this would solve the issue of the decline of the female divinity in Mormon theology is directly in relationship to the trying to get Mormon God to look like Protestant God. And when we don't do that, when we acknowledge that God, following Mormon doctrine, following the logic that God is part of an eternal family, there's a picture going around that came out of one of those clip arts from, and it says, have you guys seen this? It says, like, my celestial family, and there's God, I assume, because he's got a white beard, and then right next to him is Jesus, because he's got a brown beard, and there's these little kids, and it says, my family, and it looks like a family photo, like two bearded gay guys, like the Bears, are the ones running the, you know, we go so far to say more, families are forever, but not the ladies. They're back in the kitchen. You know, and just if you embrace this doctrine, it explains a lot of things, and it helps this issue of the femininity of the divine.
I feel obligated to say something.
Yeah, you're the
now the token woman in the room. I got to say something to that. I don't know. I got nothing.
So it's a big problem. It's a big problem. And it's a big problem because the 19th century Mormons were in love with this concept. And actually, if you go to Camas or Eureka or something, they're still in love with this idea. And it's a part of Mormonism. But when you read the Apologists, especially stuff produced by Fair and stuff, they try to pretend it doesn't exist. They really want to be accepted by the Protestants.
Yeah.
Mormon Expression is a listener-funded program. If you like what you hear, please visit us at mormonexpression.com and consider becoming a subscribing member. While you're there, let us know what you think about the show.
Biblical translation and interpretation by modern church authorities. This is a little bit more sophisticated one. This is a little bit more graduate level, which is as the Mormon apologists go out and deal with people who are educated in theology. The more you get educated in theology, the more fucked up like the translations and interpretations that the general authorities and Joseph Smith had of the Bible become transparent. For example, nobody who goes and gets a degree in divinity these days will argue that Isaiah was written by one person. That one's been put to bed. We know that there's multiple parts to that. There's different writing styles, there's different approaches. And that is almost universally agreed upon. But because of all the things that church authorities have said and the way Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon, you can't go down that path. So the apologists are really in a bind on this issue because the things that Joseph Smith wrote and authorities have said have assumed that the King James Bible is some kind of authoritative element, and it's just simply not.
They keep thumping that, and you know, some days I want to give the church credit for sticking with King James Bible forever, because here's my credit. They've only got one thing that they have to explain away, and it was written 500 years ago. 500 years ago, you know, yeah, exactly 500 years ago, pretty close. So it's using old language that nobody uses, probably nobody used 500 years ago, you know, because they wanted to make it sound old then, and so it's actually 600-year-old language. But they stick with this stuff because it's inscrutable, right? Modern Americans that were educated in public schools don't have the literary tools to understand the Bible. So if they stick with that, then they only have to understand one thing. If they allow Mormons to read, you know, the New International Version or any of those newer versions, you know, the Rise Standard Edition, then we can see what the Bible actually says. And we've got the same problem today that English people had when Martin Luther started translating the Bible into German, or when William Tyndale started translating it in English. You know, all these people see what the Bible says and they're going, holy crap, that's not what they told me at church. You know, they told me something completely different. You know, where's the thing in the Bible where it says I have to pay penance and I have to confess my sins and I have to do all of these things? That stuff's not in the Bible, right? But
that's
they've been
God
taught that.
That's why God invented exegesis.
But so, you know, I see that the church's defense of the King James Version is kind of a similar thing. If you use this inscrutable Bible, then people will assume when they hear something that they don't understand that it's them.
That it's holy. Well, and also the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible is something all apologists wish would just disappear. Because it was done at great expense and Joseph was pretty proud of it. And it's complete and utter nonsense. And we're just trying to pretend it didn't. I remember being taught that, oh, well, you see, the reorganized church got a hold of it. And they really changed. It was like the Lucy Harris sort of thing. They messed with it. It was really great when it came out of the hand of Joseph. No, it wasn't. It's a mess. It's an absolute mess. And they'll redefine the word translate. Oh, it's just Joseph Smith's commentary. That still doesn't explain why it's such bullshit, you know, because it's bad and it's weird and it's not good doctrine, and it reflects Joseph Smith's thinking at the time. The thinking between the Nauvoo period and the late Upper New York period. And by the time Nauvoo came on, we'd moved away, but here Joseph Smith planted that middle early Mormonism thinking into the Old Testament, and then it was outmoded by 1837. And, oh, this is a headache for apologists.
And they translated from what exactly? There's no plates. There's nothing. What do you mean translated?
Translation never meant translation. It always meant, you know, inspired reinterpretation. But the problem is whichever article of faith it is, the second or third article of faith that says we believe the Bible to be the Word of God as far as it's translated correctly. Okay, so somebody show me which scripture it is in the King James Version that is translated incorrectly.
Well, it's been translated correctly. Joseph Smith went and did it. He fixed it.
Right.
It's fixed, right?
Okay, so if that's true, then let's start using the Joseph Smith translation in Sunday school, right?
Right.
Oh, we don't want to do that.
No,
well, why
it's,
not?
Because it's
why
nonsense.
Not? Right. And it doesn't, there's no scrap of manuscript anywhere on the planet that says the things that the Joseph Smith translation says. So we're stuck with this translation thing again.
Right.
If Joseph Smith is saying what God meant to say, then A, either God doesn't know how to reveal this in the first place, or B, someday that manuscript will show up. Well, it's been 2,000 years, and the manuscripts that support the Joseph Smith translation haven't showed up yet. So it's problematic.
And proof of this is if you go get the Salt Lake edition of the Bible, it has some of the Joseph Smith translation footnoted, but not all of it. I mean, why wouldn't they footnote all of it? Because they don't want to. All right. Moving on. So the next one is Joseph Smith's character /morality. That Joseph Smith's character failings have been very well noted. The problem the apologists have is they're battling the church on this one. Because, I mean, there's a fairly good defense, and it's the one that Bushman had really brought out, which is, you know, the whole rough stone rolling, and God does not always select perfect individuals, you know, like think David and different characters from the Bible. But the problem is inside the pews, inside the church, they're deifying Joseph Smith, and Exhibit A, I know I refer, is the Del Parson painting where Jesus and Joseph Smith are exact same model. They're the same. They look exactly the same. That Joseph Smith has become such an icon inside the church that the apologists have a hard time dealing with this because they wanted to write his character, but the mainline church is going to scream bloody murder when they do that. But the evidences of fraud and conviction, shenanigans with banking, you know, like the stuff he was doing with the Kirtland Safety Society, marching his little army into Missouri, land speculation in Nauvoo.
In Kirtland.
I mean, these things are well documented. And it's kind of hard, if you don't already accept Joseph Smith as a prophet, to look at this guy who's constantly doing these sort of shady deals and say, wow, this is God's mouthpiece.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right. They should just say, yeah, he was weird. He was weird.
See, and if it were me, I would say, well, haven't you read the Bible? Joseph's a dick because God's a dick. They go well together. You know, they're all doing shady, bland deals. All right, moving forward. The doctrine of the curse of darkness. This is a huge issue that they want to go away, but it's buried so deep in the Book of Mormon that it's you can't extract it. And and it's in the Pearl Great Price, and it's in so much of what people have said. I'm really surprised it's still the doctrine, the Book of Mormon is still full of some pretty racist shit in there. The whole story is racist, right?
The Book of Mormon.
The entire Book of Mormon is based on that. And we say, oh, we give them the priesthood now. But the book is still based on this curse. And the curse is dark skin. And they're cursed so that the white people won't want to fuck them. That's what it says in the book, right? That's what my edition says.
did you cross that out and put the correct translation into your Bible?
Is that the John Larson translation of the Book of Mormon?
And even look when a bunch of Lamanites join with the Nephites, they put them in their own special little place down in the South, right? On a plantation. It's a racist book. And these doctrines are everywhere. And my God, the only thing you can do is pretend they don't exist, you know?
Yeah, you're right. It's in all of the books. Well, maybe not in the Doctrine and Covenants. I can't think of an example in the DNC, but it's in, you know, it's in the Pearl of Great Price. It's in the Book of Mormon, and certainly Brigham Young had a lot to say about the coloreds.
And all the way up to Kimball, yeah. You know, a long track of racism, and you know, Hotel Utah until the '60s had, you know, if you were black, you had to go in through the back service door. So these same elements, slavery, Utah was basically a slave state, if it would have been a state. This is a problem for apologists because there's, you know, they want to say, oh, in 1978 God changed his mind. But the doctrine, the racism, is so baked into Mormonism that it's hard to get rid of, and apologists don't want to talk about it.
And also, 78, the curse is removed. So how come there's still black people?
It's policy.
Or I was thinking about this. DNA kind of gives them an out with the whole origin of the Native Americans, because skin color is a function of DNA. So clearly God changed their DNA. That's why it doesn't match Hebrew DNA.
Well, you said something important, which is in 1978 this curse was removed, which is Mormon doctrine. Not in 1978 we realized there wasn't a curse. Right? Mormons still believe there was a curse up until 1978.
Right.
When it was removed. All right. The Book of Mormon is a 19th century work. This is more graduate level, but for people who know Christian theology and people who know American history, when you read the Book of Mormon, it is clearly about the 19th century. It's clearly about... an example I'll give is baptism by immersion for the remission of sins. This is something Mormons harp on. You hear nobody else talking about it. It was a 19th century idea. It wasn't in the early church. It's not really around today, but it was in the 19th century. And lo and behold, also the Mesoamericans had this as a big concern. You know, so language structure, social structure, the understanding of warfare, the understanding of weaponry, just all of these elements really reflect a 19th century romanticization of the Mesoamerican ideal.
American democracy shows up in the Book of Mormon.
American exceptionalism, yes.
Yeah. The revivals show up. You know, the revivals that Joseph Smith talked about happening in upstate New York also show up in the Book of Mormon.
Well, and even things like how specific the Book of Mormon is on American history up until 1830. Like, as if nothing after 1830 happened that was in, you know, like, is Christopher Columbus really more important than World War I? Or, you know, it's just like the, it's, anyway. Okay. Yeah, so basically why this is a problem for apologists is it's easy for somebody who knows this stuff to pick it apart. And it's funny because the Campbellites pointed this out. Like, you can find tracts written from like 1834 where they point this out, you know, saying this does not look like, you know, like all the best arguments against the church have been around since the foundation of the church. Okay, the doctrine of polygamy. Of course, one still haunts Mormonism. This is hard to deal with because they've never retracted it at all. And I will challenge anybody to push on me on that point. It is still there. It is still alive.
It's still very much policy. I mentioned in passing before in when they wrote the first manifesto in whenever that was 1890. 90 was it 90 or 96? Gosh, I can't remember my history now.
1890 was the right. first manifesto. The second one was 1904.
That's why I'm confused. So in 1890, they said, we're going to stop practicing polygamy. No more marriages will be solemnized in the temple. They didn't deal with the problem of these people that are already married, and they didn't deal with the doctrinal problem. They just said, we're going to stop marrying people.
And they still haven't dealt with the doctrinal problem.
They still haven't. And in fact, they're still very much holding on to it because, the example that everybody uses is several of the apostles are sealed to more than one woman.
Yeah, I use the example. There's a 2003 BYU speech by Dallin Oaks, and he brags openly that he's sealed to two women who are his eternal companion. He's a standing prophet right now. That these guys still believe this stuff, and don't let anybody tell you they don't.
They do, and it's still it's important to note that it's still only men can have multiple wives. It's not just a question of, hey, it's okay to marry again in the temple after your spouse dies. It's men can marry in the temple again after their wife dies, and that's still codified in the Handbook of Instructions. So mm-hmm. It's still part of the doctrine.
They can't ever rescind it because then it makes all of our great great grandmas whores.
And she was a lovely woman.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to that inerrancy and stuff like that. It's like if you start trying to pick apart. I mean, I've said this before. What if the church decides to remove all the nonsense from the Doctrine and Covenants? left. So that's part of the problem. All right, the first vision. The first vision is one they actually. The apologists think they have a better hand than they do. They try to deal with this quite often. But it does provide. It's what's fascinating about the first vision is the church relies on some very specific details on some things, and then vagueness, like the church's obsession with dates, except the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood. We don't know. We don't care. You know, it's like
some dates are more important.
Couldn't you go ask God? Like, I mean, aren't you the prophet? I mean, couldn't you go say, hey? And you'll see these articles. You know, I love like BYU studies that do these. These amazingly specific articles on minutiae. Have you guys followed this? This has been a track for several years. They've been checking weather patterns to try to determine the exact time of the first vision. Because they know it was in the spring, but now we have enough sophisticated data that we can track to see when it was an actual sunny day. No, I'm not making this shit up. You go look it up. But of course, the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood can't be resolved. It's probably a topic we need to have for a podcast because there are two conflicting pieces of information that are non-reconcilable that the church has if they pick a date, which is why they never will.
Well, and they, you know, they get so much mileage when they've got specifics and they can build these, you know, strong historical cases. And then when you bring up something like the Melchizedek priesthood, they flip it around and say, why are you getting hung up on
details? Why is that important? We don't have to know
that. You're missing the point.
It's
about the priesthood being back, not about when.
But we know the day that the Relief Society was organized so that we can have a Relief Society birthday party every year. And we know the day that the Aaronic priesthood was restored so we can have an Aaronic priesthood party every year. And we know the day that the saints got into the valley and so we can have a party for that every year.
We know what
we know
Jesus
a lot of dates.
Born.
We know what day Jesus was born so we can have a party there and you know, hopefully put conference on that day too. Until that date isn't important. You know, picking up on what you said, John, the apologists are doing, I think, decent work addressing the problem of the first vision or the four or six accounts of the first vision. They're stuck. You're right. They're stuck in a tough position. Ideally, what they would say is, there's a lot of stuff here, and isn't it marvelous that we have four versions of this revelation written down so that we know more about it rather than if we had only heard it once. The problem is, as you say, we're getting very specific about Jesus said this during the vision, and except in the visions where Jesus wasn't there. Right. Jesus, and you know, said, "I was forgiven of my sins," except in the versions where I went for the forgiveness of sins, and in the versions of the story where he didn't go to, you know, receive remission of his sins, he went to learn which church was true. Then in those, you know, somebody tells him which church is true. Except that he didn't ask that in everyone. So, you know, we've been very specific about what items we value out of this story, and that's why we can't just broad stroke it now and say he saw God and God told him to organize a church. That's what they should all be.
Well,
just those two things.
This is a classic example. This one's hard for the apologists because I think you have a good point that if they just had to deal with the evidence, the eight accounts we have. They could construct an apologetic response to those. The problem is they have the eight accounts and they have what the church has been saying. So to actually deal with the evidence and give a reasonable apologetic response puts them in contradiction with the church. And that's a hard position that the apologists are oftentimes in, is that they do have better responses, but then you have these doofus blowhard ex-attorneys who are general authorities up there saying stupid stuff, and they have to deal with that because they can't contradict them. They can't just say, well, he didn't know what he was talking about. He's only just a member of the 12.
Still, kudos. You know, the church on LDS.org put this as one of the things that they're wanting to officially address in the gospel questions or gospel topics section. They did address it, and fairly straightforwardly, I thought. So kudos to them.
Well, it's just like the problem all Christianity has with the four gospels, because they say the same things, like, isn't it amazing that God gave us four testimonies of Jesus? Yeah. But, of course, they are all paradoxically contradictory to each other, and they all betray editorial bias and Sitzenleben.
Yeah.
And, you know, it simply just opens up, it just destroys the credibility of any one of them.
Well, I think this issue is especially difficult for apologists because of what that story means in Mormon culture. I mean, how many of us were missionaries decades ago can still recite the first vision in English and maybe your mission language too, you know, it's like,
German, right?
It's like this
I've had
huge
enough fear that it's all gone.
it's this huge thing, you know, polygamy is like, maybe it's kind of over in the corner a little bit, but
yeah,
but
the first vision
is like, we hang so much of what it means to be a Mormon and what we say is valuable about the church on this one thing.
Well, the first vision is one of the stories that has always been a missionary discussion, right? Discussions come and go, but the first vision's always there.
Well, it's like Peter handing the keys to Clement for the Catholics. If that didn't happen,
then
the whole
then,
thing
yeah,
is gone.
Catholic
yeah.
Church.
Well, the first, I can't remember if we've done, it's been 5 years. I can't remember if we did a podcast on this, but I do have an old presentation, a PowerPoint that goes through all the details on this. And but the first vision wasn't important until 1879 for various reasons. Maybe I'll just tease it there. Okay, the last two. Historical secrecy and cover-up. This is a hard thing for apologists to deal with. It's becoming more and more apparent in the age of the internet because the church has actually taken broad steps to exegize its own history, to smear it, to cover it up, to make sure. And you know, I remember I have two copies of the Doubleday version because when it came out, I ran to Deseret Book and got the second one. And because the church has a tendency, I think in my book collection, I have three different copies of books that are first editions where I have both, where the church has fucked with them and then reproduced them without advancing that it's a second edition. And, okay, people like me are out here, church, and we're watching, and in the day of the internet, you can't do this stuff anymore. But the church has this long history of fudging things because to do that internally. But now it's all going to be laid clear. All your sins are going to be shouted from the rooftop, church. And this is a big problem for apologists: the secrecy, the denials, the pretending that things didn't happen.
The cover-ups.
Yeah,
yeah. The apologetics themselves. You know, if you come up with something embarrassing, Mountain Meadows, for instance, that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, don't explain that. Don't.
No,
you know,
just say it's, yeah, this was wrong. And I've long had this fantasy project that's too much work to go through, like the Gospel and the Fullness of Times, the college level textbook on church history, and just to do a project, we can crowdsource it and go through and mark everything that's missing, everything that's wrong, everything that's and it's just so full of garbage that nobody who's a serious scholar, inside or outside the church, would use any church publication on church history. At least not after, what's his name, the alcoholic historian.
I don't know who you're talking about, Bagley?
No, we're way back. He was in the Quorum of the Twelve. He wrote a book where Roberts, B.H. Roberts.
Roberts.
He's the last church historian publishing church materials that I think were of any real value.
We've all heard more than one story of exit narratives where somebody learns some historical fact, and it's not the historical fact that leads them out. It's the church lied. That's the thing that does it. I remember specifically a guy says he learned that Joseph Smith fired back at Carthage. And it didn't bother him that Joseph fired back. It bothered him that nobody told him.
Right. Yeah, this is a big fight I got into with some apologists one time. They wanted my blood. Because I said you can't really call Joseph Smith a martyr. Not that he wasn't murdered, but somebody goes down in a gunfight really isn't, by definition, a martyr. They didn't like me for that. Okay, so the problem is you can't get that cat bat in the back in the bag. You can't put this one back. The church has to deal with this secrecy and cover-ups, and it's been done. And it's really hard to retreat from. It's really hard to not show that you were really just trying to screw things up.
And it's ham-fisted, too. They want to disavow the Journal of Discourses. Well, it's a little bit late for that. It's been published for 100 years.
Well, and like I remember, I got a big fight on this one years ago where they try to say, hey, this was stenography. Who knows what the minister... But you go through the number of publishing and signatures on that and how extensively the book has been quoted and used. And for a modern person to come and say, we really don't know if the stenographer has got this right. Oh, my God. This argument is just nonsense, you know? And the problem is the same stenographers responsible for that are responsible for good portions of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Yeah.
And once you start dismissing those things, you have a problem.
Yeah, well, it just, you know, people talk frequently in my circles about the downfall of the church is going to be the internet because you can't keep secrets on the internet. Well, guess what? That's true. But it's always been true that you can't keep secrets. You know, it's just a lot faster to find out the truth on the internet than it was when you had to go to the library and read a book.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, the last one on the list is the loose versus tight translation. I'm going to do this as a teaser. We're going to dig into this one here in a couple weeks. This is a big problem for the church and with the Book of Mormon. The loose versus tight translation problem is this. It's one of two ways the Book of Mormon was produced. One is it was produced by a tight translation process, meaning God dictated every single word specifically. Or, alternatively, God just sort of gave the impression of what was going on, and the translators, Cowdery and Smith primarily, put it in their own language and put their own spin on it. One of the problems is the apologists switch back and forth between these two arguments over and over and over again, and they're mutually exclusive. You can't have them both. So if you want to explain how there was a loose translation and they were and the words like Deseret appear in there, you got a big problem. And once again, we're going to go into a lot of details about this in a few weeks here. But I think this is emblematic of a lot of the problems of apologetics in general. This is why I kind of finished the list with it. Because apologetics, even if you read a single copy of the Farms Book of Review or whatever they call, they will oftentimes deploy science here to make their case. But in the next article, they'll say something that's contradictory to that. And the next article is something contradictory. If I have any problem with apologetics, is that there is no unified science of apologetics. They will use whatever they need to prove their case. And if you want to go through and say, all right, there's been many years of Farms writing, let's take all this together and come up with a systematic theology of Mormonism. You can't, because they're only taking each piece by piece by piece. So they will use tight translation to explain like ado, but they'll use loose translation to, you know, to explain, oh, well, the counts of the war, whatever. And I'm not giving good examples right here tonight, but they will use they'll go back and forth in ways that are contradictory and not consistent.
That's a good overview. Let's talk about that in a couple of weeks.
Well, all right. The Book of Mormon has quotations, and how can you quote somebody loosely but still have "and King Benjamin said,"
right,
so on,
right,
so on,
right. Well, and then, of course, it's been changed quite a bit. You know, the Tanners famously did their 3,000 changes, of which most are nonsense. But there's some good ones in there. And the book I like the first version with its grammatical, you know. It wasn't grammatically incorrect.
It's folksy.
Nephi went
it's a 19th century.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Spicy.
Yeah. It's spicy. And I really like that Benjamin shows up after he's dead. That's my favorite part of the book.
I think it's odd. Years ago in Missionland, again, I had a Farms article that had a thing about, you know, they dug through a Deseret alphabet printing of the Book of Mormon, and we're mispronouncing everything, because the Deseret alphabet is purely phonetic. Every character makes a sound, and that's the sound it makes. And according to that, it's Nephi, Lehi, and Deseret.
Wow.
And I always wondered. I read that, and I thought, like, wait, where did everything go wrong? How did we get Nephi and Lehi and Deseret?
This is important stuff. I need to know how to pronounce Kerlom and Cumum.
I thought it was Kumong, not come on.
See?
Come on? What?
I said Cumum.
Oh.
See? Now we've had an argument that we can solve this argument with the Deseret alphabet. Learn something new every day.
So God bless those poor little apologists. They have their work cut out for them. Can you imagine if this was your job?
It's nobody's job, John. This is all volunteer work. Nobody is paid for apologetics. Get it right.
Just what you were saying, how they have their work cut out for them. I mean, on top of all these issues that they have, on top of this, you know, when we're going through our mental gymnastics trying to figure things out, we look at their answers and we say, well, but why should we believe you? The church doesn't even endorse what you're saying whatsoever. It's like you're some independent third party that may or may not be funded, you know, by the church or whatever, but what authority do they have? Why should we believe them? That's the challenge that's on top of all of these issues that they have.
Well, it's not the challenge. It's the beauty of this. And I want to give a shout out to Dr. Shades on episode number 2 of Mormon Expression.
Wow.
Because, yeah, I know. I had to look it up, too. Shades said something on that episode where he said the beauty of apologists is that they're not endorsed by the church. And so they can say any crazy thing that they want, and Mormons will listen to them and go, wonderful, I've got my answer. And then if some asshole like you comes along and says, yeah, but this doesn't make any sense, the church can go, those apologists, they say crazy stuff all the time. They get to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
All of those counter anti-Mormon apologetic books I read all contained the Mormon Miranda of, I do not speak for the church. Yeah. I am not operating. I'm not sanctioned or authorized in any way to talk about all this stuff. Right. This is just what the Spirit motivates me to do.
Right.
You know, and which was strange to me. Where it's like, first off, why can't the church fight their battles? Yeah. You know, why do they need some guy in Arizona printing out of his garage to do this?
Yeah, read some tract by Michael Ash, and you know, he might say, I don't speak for the church, but I don't know how he says it with a straight face, because he's very emphatic.
I don't know, I haven't done it in a while. I think I did in the first year of Mormon Expression. I did reverse the Mormon Miranda, and I do, in fact, speak for the church. So you can trust me. All right, well, the apologists, I think you're absolutely right, that the church has done these things to keep them under. You can see this tension, you know, like farms opened up, you know, south of BYU campus, they moved it onto campus, and they move it around here, and there's this tension because, frankly, the 12, the guys leading the church, are way over their head on doctrine issues. I don't think it's merely the fact they don't want to make any pronouncement. They have no idea what to even say. You know, you listen to these guys in conference, and they're not real theologians in any sense. They don't know their own theology. They don't know. They just know the same stuff that's been repeated over and over again. And they're selected that way. We've talked about this a lot before. They're lawyers and they're accountants and they're businessmen and they're set up to run a big, huge $9 billion a year corporation. And that's what they're selected for. They're not selected because they understand the nuances of church theology and how things have grown and how things have progressed. And they're scared of it. They could. You could have a great class at BYU. Mormon theology is not that weird. Or, in other words, I think all theology is weird, and Mormonism is one of them. And they could just say, just embrace Mormonism the way it is. And they could do it down at BYU and start it out, but these guys are scared because they don't understand it. And they have these problems we've established.
Apologetics is basically an intellectual enterprise, but their best friend is ignorance. You know, my buddy went to Mexico City on his mission, and none of this stuff came up, ever. Because, like you said before, you can tell what the church wants people to know by what they translate into Spanish. Nobody in Mexico knows anything about polygamy, or mountain meadows, or none of it. It's just not an issue, because they're ignorant. They don't know anything about it.
Well, that ignorance speaks maybe the final case I'll use for what we're talking about here. There's a great talk from about 4 or 5 years ago. I think it's Dowan Oaks again. It might have been. That talks about the proper use of thee, thou, and thine. Which, of course, the church is misusing. Everybody understands this, right? When we read the Bible, and Jesus sometimes says you, and he sometimes uses those had a different meaning.
And it's exactly the opposite of what we believe it is.
Exactly the opposite. You was formal, and
thou was familiar.
Thou was familiar.
Yeah.
And I was mistaught that you was, like many languages have pluralized articles, whatever that is, and that you is singular you and ye is plural you.
But they should know this, or they should be able to call up somebody from the linguistics department. Or the theater department, maybe, and say, hey, I just want you to fact check my talk
somebody
here.
Somebody that lives in Pennsylvania and knows this, Amish people.
So the apologists hear this stuff from conference and they say, oh, no. Because everybody else who knows the Bible listens to a talk like that and says, your authority for God, has no idea what the fuck he's talking about. But we just merrily go along and march that down and teach it to kids, and it's wrong. It's just dead wrong. But then we'll redefine it. This is the actual way it should have been. And the church could use with a little bit of historical knowledge. And the poor apologists, I feel sorry for them, because they usually know these things. They have to weave some kind of bizarre narrative out of this, and it is a tough job.
But they'll always have a job.
They always will. There's always been apologists with us, and they probably always will be, because religion is always wrong. All right. Well, you... there's nowhere to go from there, right? That sums it all up. The Thane and I were talking right before the podcast. There's a companion podcast this week put on the schedule, which is the... what did we call it? The actual apologist, like stupid apologist tricks.
We just
went through the ways that the big problems they have. These are the most problematic areas to deal with in Mormon theology.
And we didn't talk about idiotic techniques.
No. So we'll put that on there. We'll tease that in a couple months. We'll go through actual stupid apologetic techniques.
Well, John, the thing about all these difficult arguments is that if the church was just like upfront with any of this stuff, there wouldn't be anything for the apologists to do, right? Because I think people can handle a fair amount of, like, people can handle a lot, and a lot of honesty and a lot of difficult stuff if they just said what was going on, but they can't really do that now.
You're right. I've repeated before that it's not that bad. Like, the doctrine of God being a human being is not that bad of a doctrine as far as doctrines go. But they've covered up and they've obfuscated and they've played games and done all this stuff, which leaves this weird, tricky spot they're in. Yeah. And if they would just have come clean if they'd just done what they tell us to do, just to be honest with it, then there wouldn't be a problem.
Exactly.
One of my very favoritist podcasts, The Human Bible with Dr. Robert Price, every episode has a counter-apologetics section that he entitled "Apologetics is never having to say you're sorry."
Well, it's not a fun job, and it's not fun to defend. All right. Well, thanks everybody for another fabulous discussion. Thanks for coming in from the West Coast, representing the West Coast Mormons, who are just as crazy as the Utah Mormons. Becca?
Yeah, so I hear. I don't know. I don't really mingle with them much out there.
Verified.
Verified.
And, of course, Thane.
You got a witness.
And Flip. Let's see. The discussion will always continue at the website at mormonexpression.com. I was going to announce this at the beginning, but I'll put it at the end for people who powered through. I'm announcing right now that... we are starting a drive. We are starting a drive for 250 memberships. Did I do this already in the podcast? 250 subscriptions to the podcast. When we hit 250 subscriptions to the podcast, we will begin broadcasting live on Monday nights. Or Tuesday. It's actually Tuesday. It's on Tuesday nights. So
the first 250 subscribers get front row seats.
Yes. Yeah, no one's sitting in the front row. So there's your motivation to go out to mormonexpression.com, subscribe to the podcast, and when we hit that goal, we're going to be in live broadcasting with call-in equipment. So, one of the reasons we need that is we need to upgrade our equipment a little bit, and you'll be able to call in live to the podcast, and we're really looking forward to it.
Neat.
Yeah, it'll be fun. All right, thanks everybody. Good night.
Expression is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find more about our current initiatives. Mormon Expression is recorded live in downtown Salt Lake on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. If you're in the area, please come join us in the studio.